You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, and being the second Wednesday of the month, we've got our legal team from Hutchinson Legal. We've got with us today Madeleine and Rachel. Welcome, ladies.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Alan.
It's great to see the two of you.
Thank you.
We sent the people away last time with actually three questions, and the first one, what's the longest criminal trial that's in, how long it's lasted in Victoria, and what's the cost of this? And they may not be the same trial.
No, no. So it actually proved a little bit more difficult than we thought to find one in Victoria.
Right.
And really, the only one I came up with was the Walsh Street murder trial, the right. killings of Tynan and whoever they were, the two police officers in Walsh Street. That went for 7 weeks.
Yeah.
But in Australia, there's longer ones. Australia-wide, there's what was touted as one of Australia's longest-running murder trials in Sydney in 2017 was the trial where a Chinese gentleman was found guilty of murdering his wife, Kathy, and their relatives in his residence in 2009. So that... That's the question, isn't it? How long did that go? 7 years.
Seven years.
And four different hearings, yes.
Why? Because was there challenges to it? I think so.
There would have been perhaps hung juries and retrials and maybe appeals in lower courts. But it took 7 years and four different hearings for him to be found guilty.
So if he was in jail that whole time, he'd have maybe served a third of his time.
Exactly.
Before he was found guilty.
Yeah, but he maintains his innocence to this day. That was the last thing he said in court. I did not murder the Lynn family. I'm innocent.
Right.
But, we had quite a bit of trouble sort of tracking down what was the actual longest one and got very... you get into all the interesting aspects of the trials along the way.
Yep.
But the other one, was probably the longest, which was the Croatian Six were sentenced to prison in 1981 for conspiracy to bomb several Sydney targets. Australia's longest-running terrorism saga is set to finally end 44 years, 1 month and 7 days after it began.
44 years.
Yeah. So don't tell me, don't ask me all the ins and outs of that. Though, what led to it taking 44 years? But
so, what was the costliest trial?
Okay. Well, I don't know that. But since that's the second question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is what sort of costs are involved?
Yeah.
And in the Claremont serial killings in Western Australia. The cost topped $11
million. $11
million? So that is probably one of the costliest criminal trials. But everything I've been talking about so far is criminal.
Yep.
If we get to...
Corporate,
that's right. And the Bell trials, which was Alan Bond's subsidiary.
Yeah.
Somewhere in Perth tonight, there are likely to be two separate and significant celebrations by parties on either side of what has come to be known as the Bell case to mark the 404th and final day in Australia's longest-running action. So that they're claiming the longest-running action without retrials and so forth. The final bill for engaging seven silks, 11 junior counsels, 7 partners and an army of junior staff for the trial period of more than 3 years. That's not 404 days, is it? No. They're saying more than 3 years.
Yeah.
Is expected to total over $300 million, making it possibly, probably Australia's most expensive case as well. So that was some case.
The lawyers would have been happy with that.
Probably. and
All right, so the other one, and we'll just take that quickly if we can.
Yeah.
This was about the reference, about a reference being used that was 10 years old, how can a person, if they are writing a character reference, make sure that it doesn't come up in a situation where they don't want it used many years later?
Well, the short answer is they can't, really. If they're giving a reference, they are supposed to be speaking the truth, and it's only their opinion.
Yeah.
And they can't really retract it later, because it is their opinion. It obviously depends how it's used.
Yep.
But we did come up with a case unexpectedly, which is that a person giving a reference does have a duty of care to the employee that they're talking about, and they can't make misstatements that are going to harm them down the track, so that are incorrect.
Because some do that, don't they?
Yeah.
To get rid of an employee.
Well, that's right. yeah. So they need to be careful about that. And that this case, which was an English case, extended the or went round the law of defamation, because the defamation laws, you have to have an element of malice, whereas for a negligent reference, it can just be negligence. It doesn't have to be on purpose, trying to malign them. That you can just make a misstatement. So you need to be really careful not to do that.
Yep. All right. Look, we've just got to take a quick break.
Sure.
I'll just play with this computer for half a tick. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Wake up, well I know I'm gonna be the man who wakes up next to you. When I go out, yeah I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. If I get drunk, well I know I'm gonna be the man who gets drunk next to you. And if I heaver, yeah I know I'm gonna be the man who's heavering to you. But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more than be the man who walked 1,000 miles then fall out at your door. When I'm working, yes I know I'm gonna be the man who's working hard for you. And when the money comes in for the work I do, I'll pass almost every penny on to you. When I come home, I know I'm gonna be the man who comes back home to you. And if I go, well I know I'm gonna be the man who's going over you. But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more than be a man who walks 1,000 miles. I'm gonna be the man who's lonely without you. And when I'm dreaming, well I know I'm gonna dream about the time when I'm with you. When I go out, well I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. And when I come home, yes, I know I'm gonna be the man who comes back home with you. I'm gonna be the man who's coming home.
Yarra Valley FM 99.1.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, I don't want to worry you, Madeleine, but I've been waiting for
worried.
I've been waiting for you to come along. We've had two or three questions. We've had a few, and I'm going to put them into two separate questions. But I was also grateful when I found out that Rachel's coming along and she knows a bit about caveats. All right, so very, very briefly, there's a husband and wife and then three or four kids, whatever. One of them dies, and, of course, the other partner inherits everything. So that's fine. As they're going along, one of the sibling or one of the children think, for some reason, when this partner dies or this mum or dad dies, they should get a bigger share of the will for some unknown reason. So they're not sure what's going to happen. So they go and they put a caveat on the property so that it can't be sold. Now, a couple of things happen. First of all, can you put that? Oh, no, sorry. And there's more of the question. I nearly messed it up. But that makes sense, yeah? So then in the will, they've said they've got really annoyed about this caveat going on the property, really annoyed.
Yep.
So they've put in their will, if the person challenges the will, their share is to go to charity. So the first thing is, can they do that? Is it likely to be upheld? Secondly, and this is for Rachel, between the two to answer. Rachel, this person put the caveat on. Can anybody else, without having to go to court, get the caveat taken off? And because there is a question here that when the person dies, if this caveat's on the property and if the other siblings don't agree, that they could leave that caveat on for years. And there could be a property sitting there for years that nobody can sell. So the question is, A, first of all, Madeleine, in the will, is that likely to happen, where they say if they challenge it, then they're going to lose their share to charity? A, can they do that? And B, will it work? C, to you, Rachel, once a caveat's on, can anybody else take it off? And if not, what's to stop the scenario I've just put, where the caveat stays for the years and nobody gets anything? So I'll leave it up to you two to answer.
Great question, Alan. Well, I'll deal with the first part and then I'll hand over to Rachel. So the first part is, can you contract out of legislation, or can you make a will that attempts to avoid the legislation? And the short answer is no. So the Administration and Probate Act provides a section of the Act which is devoted for claiming further provision if you feel you are entitled to greater provision in a will.
Right.
And that's very definitely laid out sections, which there's a group of people who are called eligible people who can make such a claim, and an adult child is one of them.
Yep.
Then there's a whole lot of criteria which will affect the decision of the court as to whether they're entitled to greater provision than was left for them.
So that's not going to... So the law is not going to allow them to lose their section just because... their part just because they challenge?
No. Well, it's not going... No, it's not going to take any notice of a clause in the will which says that.
Yep.
Because the legislation provides that someone can make an application for greater provision.
Yep.
The court will take into account the intention of the testator, and certainly must look at the provisions in the will. So they'll take that into account, that was the testator's state of mind.
Yep.
And that's what they didn't want any challenges whatsoever. Yep. But it won't necessarily preclude them from being successful.
Right.
So, yeah, can you lodge a caveat on the property?
Already there. So what's...
Well, in the first place, it wouldn't... Someone might be able to put the caveat on, but they'd be doing the wrong thing in doing so. You can't lodge a caveat on a property that you don't have an interest in.
Well, it's already there, the caveat, but from the person who rang.
Yeah, okay, so... Yeah, but just
the question
sort of,
is, yeah. should it be?
Should it be?
Yeah, right. What are the consequences? It should not,
yeah.
is the short answer. But to have a caveatable interest, you need to have put money into this property. You can't just have the expectation that when someone dies, they are going to leave an interest to you. You don't have an interest in that property at that time.
Right.
You can't lodge a caveat on that property. An expectation is not enough.
Right.
But if someone was to do that, there'd be a few different consequences for a few different people involved, including the conveyancer or lawyer who lodged that caveat in the first place. But right. we get to the point, this erroneous caveat is there. The first step is always negotiation.
Yep.
So go straight to the person who's got the caveat on the property, and you no two ways about it. You sort of threaten them to say, no, you have no grounds for a caveat. You need to right. remove it right away. If they don't, you can progress the matter to court and seek legal costs for doing so against the person who put the caveat on.
So the scenario that I brought up can't happen, where a caveat could stay there by one of the siblings for years and nobody can sell the property.
No, because there is always the opportunity to go to court and have it removed. There are some administrative pathways as well. If you say can't get in touch with the person who's got the caveat on the property, there is always a pathway forward. But no, you don't have to wait until they voluntarily remove the caveat.
Right.
And I just say, Alan, it's the executor's responsibility to get that caveat removed and to argue that the cost be paid by the person who put it on erroneously in the first place.
Sounds good.
Yeah, the other last little thing I was just going to add is there's also a caveat which can be lodged against probate, which is a totally different sort of caveat. And if someone had grounds to allege that the testator didn't have capacity, they could lodge a caveat which would prevent the executor obtaining probate.
That's if the testator or whatever they are, that's if they weren't of sound mind.
Yeah, that's right. And say the other three beneficiaries thought that the will should be set aside because he didn't know what he was doing or whatever. There is another sort of caveat. Yeah,
I don't think there's a doubt about that. All right, look, I've got to take a quick break, but I've got another will one to come back to you.
Sure.
Here alone, and I wonder why. Friday night and everyone's cool. I can
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, and we're talking with our legal people for Hutchinson Legal, Madeleine and also Rachel. Now, on the wills again, we've got another one that we've had. All right, so there's a family again. There's a mother and a mother and father and a son. Along the line, the father dies. The mother dies. The father's left behind, and he doesn't get on very well with his only child, and that child then goes off and has two children. Now, when he passes on, he knows that if he leaves his money to one person, that the money's never going to get distributed down the line. So he's written his will that 50% goes to this people, which is his child, and then the other 50% is divided 25% each between his grandchildren. But he knows there are problems with a couple of them who really just want to argue about money, and they all want to be the only person that gets any money. So this is a real hassle. However, it's a bit like the last one that they've put in their will, and I think you're going to give me the same answer again, in their will that if anybody challenges, their share goes to a charity. Now, so are we saying that's not legal?
Yes, we are. And again, it all boils down to, first of all, what's the moral obligation that the testator has to make provision for his... Who does he have a moral obligation to make provision for? And it normally is adult children.
I don't want to interrupt you, but would the child therefore be more entitled than what the grandchildren are?
Possibly, but these are the factors the court looks at it as a whole.
Yep.
And one of the big factors, I mean, if they're his children, the son's children, then that's quite a valid thing to do, to provide for grandchildren. Sure. And particularly if they're his children, he wouldn't have any reason to complain about half the estate going to his children. So no. I would say he has not got any reason to upset that will. But the court looks at, one of the big things they look at is needs, needs of the claimant.
Yep.
And unfortunately, a lot of really well established children can't see why the one living in the gutter should be looked after more than them.
Yep.
But that is the reality, that the court will look at needs, and that, and if someone has the ability to provide for their own needs, they won't be favoured as much as someone who doesn't.
So they could lose out, really, more so than
that's right. So if the son was a multimillionaire and the grandchildren were struggling, he would not have a hope of upsetting that. In fact, the grandchildren they wouldn't have. Grandchildren have to be dependent on the testator to have an automatic right.
They're adult children.
Yeah. So there's all these complex rules in the legislation that the court needs to take account of if it goes that far.
Yeah.
But these are the things we advise people not to bother or to bother. You know, if you get someone who's left out of a will who has a disability and no way of making an income, and they were completely left out, and the other four children were left comfortable, well, obviously they would have a claim. There's no question about that.
And you can't say, if you challenge this,
no,
I'm going to give your money away.
No. As I said, you can't contract out or will make out of legislation.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
No.
All right, so we've done the wills, and I guess, and you're going to tell me this is right, I guess wills are probably one of the most challenged things, are they? What people when I say, people challenging wills?
Definitely, or problems about the administration of the will, or A lot of people, there's a difference between making this claim under the family provisions legislation of the Administration and Probate Act for greater provision. There's a difference between saying, I want more, than actually this will is invalid because my father didn't have capacity at the time, or he was tricked. He didn't know what he was doing, like he didn't know the contents of the will, he didn't speak the language or whatever. Right. All of those grounds for setting aside a will are quite hard to do, and you need a lot of evidence.
And I guess you're going to say, and I could probably agree, that the days of writing your own will and that are gone, aren't they? You really need to get legal advice.
I completely recommend it.
I knew you would.
The people who say to me, why can't I just, you know, get a form from the newsagents? You can, but it just gives us lots of work later. Yeah. And the one that I've seen that just makes me shake my head and it caused a lot of litigation was where the gentleman had said, I want so-and-so to be my executor, my daughter, and I want my whole estate to be left to, and he forgot to put her name in. And there were other children from other marriages. He had a wife that he was already married to that he hadn't seen, sorry, that he was still married to, hadn't seen her for 40 years. So she goes, oh, okay, thanks, I'll have some. And there was a huge fight. If he'd just written her name in, it would have gone to the daughter, but it created an intestacy, which actually segues into Rachel, so she can talk about, not listen to my voice the whole time.
Thanks, Madeline.
What happens when you haven't got a will?
Yeah, if you haven't got a will, or if there was a will, but for reasons along like what Madeline was talking about, it's been set aside and it's no good. Yep. Where does the money go? What happens to the estate, and who's responsible for administering it? The person that's responsible for administering it is the person who has the biggest claim to the estate. And so it goes down in sort of a hierarchy order of who's available to take those assets. So the first person is if there's a partner or a spouse.
Yeah.
And when I say partner, I do mean de facto partner, and they need to have been in a relationship, still in the relationship, when the deceased passed away.
So they're number one.
They're number one.
So let me throw a curly question at you. So the guy is still married, but he's moved out and he's moved into with another woman. So he's got a partner that's he's been with for 2 or 3 years.
Yes.
And he's still got an ex-wife. So out of those two, who is the top priority?
There is no top priority. It's straight down the middle.
So it would be 50-50.
It even would be 50-50, yes.
He might unless have talked to the divorced wife.
Unless if they're still legally married, but if they've had a property settlement, a family law property settlement, then she wouldn't be entitled anymore.
Right.
Or if they've got children together, then it would go all to her in the first place if they're still married.
But even though he's got another partner?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yes. It would depend who he's actually with.
Yeah, no, the partner...
But he's got, new partner.
Yeah, he's been with her for, say, 4 or 5 years, so he's got a proper partner, but he's got an ex-wife who hasn't bothered to divorce.
Then it's 50-50. I think it is. It's 50-50.
Straight down the middle.
Except what about the children?
Yes.
I like to put in these little things.
Yeah, we weren't quite...
All right, just keep going. Sorry.
No, that's okay. So if there is no partner, goes to the children... In equal shares. If there are no children, then it goes to the parents. If there's no living parents, it goes to siblings. If there's no living siblings, it goes to grandparents. If there's no living grandparents, and down the line we go, until we do eventually get to the government, but it's going through pretty much every living relative that you can think of along the way.
Right. Can I just ask, is there any difference between when you're going down here, like you've got the partner's ex-wife and all this jazz, is there a difference between children and stepchildren, or are they both equally in the law?
Might pass that one over to you.
It is
the same.
It is the same unless they're excluded in the will.
Right.
But for the purpose of intestacy, they're the same. They're treated the same. Yep.
All right. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
To Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Now, thanks for listening.
Oh, sorry, Grant. Madeleine, we've put you through the ringer a bit today.
And absolutely.
It's a pretty heavy old subject, so you've got some funny laws you want to lighten the afternoon with.
I have, yeah. I thought I'd lighten up. So there's some archaic laws still existing in Australia and a couple in Victoria, one of which is Section 115 of the Environment Protection Act says that any person caught releasing a helium balloon will be fined up to $991 per person or $4,956 for a company. And if they do it a series of times, the fines can be up to $16,000 for a person and $82,000 for a company. So no releasing of balloons in Victoria.
And is it only if it's a helium balloon?
Well, I did look that up. That's what this little rundown says. No, I think it's both because it's the releasing of waste both pop and come down again. So I think it's both, which seems amazing. But even more strange is, and this is in Victoria, the Environment Protection Act 1970 provides that it is an offence to make unreasonable noise in your residential place at a certain time of day, and this includes the use of a vacuum cleaner any time after 10 p.m. or before 7 a.m. on weekdays, and after 10 p.m. or before 9 a.m. on weekends. And complaints from neighbours or a failure to comply with this law can result in a penalty. So you don't want your
housework at night.
No, exactly. And you don't want to live next door to a cranky neighbour who's going to make things difficult for you. So if you feel like, if you can't sleep and you just think you'll vacuum your house at 2 o'clock in the morning, no. Yep. So that's Victoria. But South Australia and the Northern Territory have laws against fortune telling. Yes. Anyone found guilty with the intention of deceiving their customers by pretending to be a fortune teller, and the thing is, it's going to be difficult to prove that they're not real, spiritualist, medium, or a role that allows them to exercise powers of telepathy, clairvoyance, or similar powers will face a maximum fine of $10,000 or imprisonment for 2 years.
True.
So you need to be the real deal if you're going to do it.
And how do you prove it?
Well, exactly. I really don't know. So, anti-hoon laws, they're not strange. And the police have been given extra power to impound, immobilise or permanently confiscate a vehicle involved in hooning offences, which is a good thing.
And they can crush them at certain rates too, can't they?
Yeah. You can really say goodbye to your vehicle if you use it.
That's my favourite one.
Yeah. Bike helmets are compulsory, we know that.
Yep.
And Rachel's just said this is her favourite. The possession, and it's in Western Australia, at least we're not quite so silly, but under Section 22 of the Marketing of Potatoes Act, anyone who is found selling, delivering or purchasing 50 kilograms or more potatoes could face a penalty of up to $2,000 for first-time offenders and $5,000 for subsequent offenders.
Why are we in Western Australia?
I really don't know what has given rise to that law. There must have been a famine sometime.
We've got to take a quick break, but Rachel, we've just had somebody ask us, and I'll get you to repeat this on air. They want to know if the caveat expires without being taken off.
Yes. Short answer is no. It does need to be removed, and we have seen caveats that just sit on title for years if they aren't dealt with. They can expire within a time frame if an application's made and it's not answered within a certain time frame.
Right.
But generally speaking, if nothing's done about it, it stays where it is.
Fair enough. All right, we'll just take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
You
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And, of course, that was Kylie with Kylie Minogue and Two Hearts. David, if you're listening, I put that in for you. I hope you enjoyed it. Now, you want to talk about sexual harassment?
Well, not particularly. It's more the point that the laws have changed on the 6th of March.
Yep.
And I just like to update listeners
yep.
to recent changes. So, apparently, the Commission now has greater powers. This is the Fair Work Commission, and the changes are made to the Fair Work Act 2009. They now have powers they've always had powers to make orders to stop sexual harassment if it's reported to them, but they now can order a conciliation, mediation or recommendation, and if none of that works, they can have an arbitration where they can order that the employer be compensated for lost wages or requiring that they be reasonably remedied for any loss or damage they've suffered. And also the new changes mean that the ombudsman can make the complaint for the person.
Oh, can they? On behalf of the person.
So, or the union for them so that they don't have to go through it all personally.
Yeah. So in the past it had to be the person themselves.
That's right. That's right.
And we should make the point that it does happen to both male and female, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
We're not just talking about males. We're not just talking about females.
No. And also, I think the point needs to be made that the pendulum swung a very long way towards awareness, but sometimes everyone can be a little bit too tense about it. And yep. I've noticed even in our workplace, not wanting to go to a coffee shop, the male's not wanting to be seen in a coffee shop with a young lawyer because... anything can be said. So yeah. Everybody's very tense.
Yeah.
I mean, these are good things. It's a good thing not to be happening.
Right.
But as with all changes, it makes everybody very hypervigilant.
Yeah.
So I think there's been a lot of change in the area and it'll take a while for it all to settle down.
But
there are changes to the Act.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
All right, look, it's... I am going to send you away with a question. Well, I'll give you part of it now and maybe part of it off air, but we'll certainly get you to come back with whoever comes in next month. And it's talking about incarceration and people in jail. Now, I've got to be very careful how I say this, but, all right, a person goes before the court. The court gives them a... certain time in jail, do they automatically just on that day do the doors just swing open and they walk out, or what happens? Now, I will tell you a little bit more off air. I'm not trying to be cute with the listeners, and we'll tell the listeners exactly what the question's all about, because by then we'll be able to talk freely. But I'll get these people to go away and come back with an answer as to what I'm talking about. It is quite interesting. We've had a question about people wanting to know whether once a person gets a jail term, whether they just walk out the door at the end of the day, or whether there's a program in place for them after that, or what actually happens. So could you get somebody to have a look at that for us, please?
Absolutely.
And... I'll tell you a little bit more about it in a minute or two when the 2 o'clock news. And I should mention on the second Wednesday of May, be May by then, at 1 to 2, the legal hour now will be on between 1 and 2. With us moving to Hillsville, we'll have people from Hutchins and Legal. So thank you, ladies, for being with us today.
Thank you.
We've had a bit of fun and we've put you on the spot, but I do appreciate what you've told us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.